You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Eva Davidova. Eva, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
Eva, I know you're in New York now, but you've traveled a lot and lived in Madrid for 15 years. But I want to begin with what you're working on now so the audience gets a sense of your work and how you approach your medium. So what is it that you're currently working on?
So for the last year almost, I've been working on a project called Global Mode, and it has very different parts of it. The majority are photo-based animation mixed with performance and CGI 3D animals. But also I'm more and more interested in virtual reality and interactivity in that space and how this can shift the power to the individual. So I'm starting to work with different people who know about programming and are interested in collaborations with art projects. The most specific thing I'm doing right now is preparing for a show next month organized by the Bronx Museum. And it's another 9 artists. We're all ex-artists in the marketplace alumni, some from 20 years ago, some like me, like from 6-7 years ago. And for this show, I want to present one of the new animations, which is called Saturn Devouring His Children. It is more about thinking about our descendants. And so Saturn is not really like in the old paintings. It's a young girl, and the descendants are all cyborg-like 3D sculptures, but not perfect and very tender in a sense. One of my questions.
So that's quite different than the image we have of Goya's, which is kind of like a horror show.
Right. Yeah. Very, very different Saturn. I did think about Goya and about other people who have worked with that image in the past. But for me, what is happening now, what we're doing, and how it unfolds needs a little bit different image. It's also kind of scary if you see the final result, but imagery itself is brought to a possible future. One of the questions I ask is in these days where reality gets mixed with virtual reality technologies, able to harvest from us and from the spaces all kind of information and dump it somewhere else or dump it completely. I'm asking if we are the games our children will program one day, could we influence that code they're writing? Could we do something to steer the future in a different direction and not what the horrors which are happening today?
Right. This is our inheritance and our responsibility, I suppose. So tell me exactly what will be shown in this group show at the Bronx Museum. Exactly what are you exhibiting there?
So the final piece which I will show is an animation which is done by a sequence of photographs from a performer, which are then slowly fused one into each other, so the movement of the performer doesn't look like real movement anymore, but it is more like almost a sculptural object in the space, and this performer is interacting with the descendants, as I call them, these 3D figures which look like very artificial, but also have some qualities of humans, like defects or skin or some things like this. So this is the animation I was thinking of. And another piece, which probably will have to be to wait for a later show, is an interactive piece where the public actually can interact with the animals in the space. They're shiny animals, and they can be anything from a goat to a horse to a rabbit with a brain in its belly, or crazy mutants. But mostly they're likable animals, and they're there to for the viewer to play with. And then while the viewer is playing or interacting with the animals, a performer appears in the space, and some kind of relief happens or surprise that there is another human into this virtual space. So this is the second.
And how do, and so just to explain that a little more, how do the viewers, and I just want to go back a little bit in the first thing you mentioned, the animation that's exhibited on a, is that projected or that's exhibited on a monitor?
It is projected, yes, it is projected. Sometimes I've done installation when there is one projection and several small monitors, or a big wall with many screens which make one animation, or I have projected directly onto buildings. In this case, it will be a projection occupying one wall.
And so, and that's Saturn devouring his children. Now, in the piece that you were just talking about, which we'll probably have to wait to, as you're saying, a different venue, how exactly are the viewers interacting and playing with the kind of mutant animals that you described?
So technically, now it's more and more possible to do complex animations and still keep the interaction. It would be a combination of lip motion, which is something you do with your hands in the air, and the camera records, like a small device records your gestures. I'm very interested in the gestural interaction in virtual reality, but also it's possible to overlay with the gaze, with the eyes control. So while the person is looking at something, this something comes toward them, and then with the gesture of their hand, they can, for example, sink the animals into water or make them fly or just hug them almost.
Okay, but wait, but I still don't understand. The viewers are controlling or interacting with an animal that's projected, and the viewers' movements kind of like the way but video games were tracking the gestures of the player. That is that partly what's happening or no, because I don't have a clear image of that.
One of the possible scenarios is that the viewer will have a virtual headset on his eyes. So the viewer will be inside with the animals, within this space with the animals. So if you've ever tried virtual reality headset, when you put it on, you're in a space different from the physical space, which you are in outside of the helmet. So it creates immediately a new situation for you, a completely new space and new images all around you. You're cut off from the outside world. So as someone said, you're snapped into a new reality. So there will be inside.
I have seen that. I have a set of goggles. And the only thing that I've seen with it are, which is, I guess, the beginning of it all, but the virtual reality kind of reporting or imagery that that the New York Times or other newspapers are starting to do now. But that's very, it's not nearly as interactive as what you're talking about. In your virtual reality project, we're looking at animals as, you know, maybe a little more like in current video games where we can interact with other figures and animals in this game. In this case, we're seeing the animals actually in our space in front of us. And you're saying we can reach out and pet them or touch them somehow?
Well, not exactly physically touch them, not yet, not in this month, maybe next month, but yes, have at least the visual sensation of touching them. And yes, as you were saying, it comes from gaming. One of my interests in virtual reality is that at this moment it's used mainly for commercial purposes, for gaming, or to present news as if they were real, when most of the times for me they're heavily staged and controlled. So I want, as an artist, to take part in this technological adventure so I can bring more individualistic approach, more content creation for everyone. One of the ideas I have, for example, is to do a class for children where they will create their own sculptures for gaming or their own characters, and they don't have to use the ready-made or the commercial characters available. So as an artist, I think what I want to do is to pull the strings of this technology towards different issues.
Right, because just like Saturn Devouring His Children or this other one you're talking about, a lot of these speak to issues of the future and how we're going to manage all these technologies. Is that part of what you're saying? Not just the technologies, but how we're going to manage the future of a planet that's really in crisis in many ways.
Exactly. Are we going to let others, corporations, the system pull us by the nose with the technology in their hands, or are we going to participate actively and create our own virtual realities, our own technologies, use them for something different than commerce or propaganda? And I think many people would say, I mean, I don't know, I want to go into that, but there are positions about technology, about how bad it is or how this and that. I think we are in it. We are in the technology world. We are in the virtual reality with at least half a foot. So we have to use it somehow in a different way than what we can see so far.
And, you know, that also kind of brings up the question of funding and sustaining yourself as an artist. So if you don't mind me asking, how is all of this funded? Because in a way, it seems like you could use a lot of resources, coders and animators and, you know, people who are experts in virtual reality. There could be a lot of, I'd imagine you need a lot of collaborators here. How do you fund this and survive?
So, do I survive? Well, it's a very pertinent question. It's an important question. I'm trying to look into grants or, for example, as this upcoming show or the show I'm just in, they give you some honorary, which is great. I think every institution and gallery should give honorary to the artist. And in these cases, I'm lucky to have that, although it's very little. Really, it doesn't support a studio in New York or the life or whatever. But I'm looking into grants, and also I'm trying to collaborate with people who are doing it for the project. So there is no big commercial interest. I'm happy to share my honoraries. But as many, many other artists, especially in New York, I've worked in advertising. I've been even writing things. I have done design. And many, many years ago, I was also a waitress. And I think it's difficult, if not. I mean, how do you jump into something new and start making immediately? It's not that easy.
Right. It's difficult, but also that enables you to continue to pursue the process, because it sounds like most of your work is also not typically in the marketplace. Is that correct? These aren't things that are easily sold or acquired.
Absolutely correct. For years, for 15 or 20 years, I was a painter. I started very early. I started almost as a kid to do exhibitions, and I was a painter, and I started doing installation after that. But I had a reasonably good career in the sense that I didn't have to work any other job or do many other things to survive. But then I started shifting my work into animation first, photography, installation, and all this got very good reviews, interest, etc., but the money suddenly like almost disappeared. So many times I rely on residencies, on some small grants, as I had a grant from the Sharewater Foundation to do a series of holograms. This was amazing. That was a wonderful thing. But definitely once you step out of the established market, it's much more difficult.
And maybe that brings up to as we get near the end of the interview, a little bit about the Artists in the Marketplace program, this exhibit that we began talking about, and many people may know the Bronx Museum, but probably a lot don't. And you mentioned that you are an alumni of the AIM, or Artists in the Marketplace, as well as others are there. Can you speak a little bit about how that program, which is notorious, well-known, and also I think a formative one for so many artists, how did the Artists in the Marketplace program at the Bronx Museum help to form your practice, or contribute to your practice, or support your practice, however you want to do it? What do you think was valuable about that program, AIM?
So I would ask what was not valuable, but yeah, the first thing, the people I met there, their thoughts, their art, their ideas. Some of them I'm still working with. One of them I did last year, a group show. I curated a show, and she was in the show. She will be my co-curator for the next show. And many other people have influenced me, and I have kept in touch with almost everybody. The things we learned from the lecturers, voluntary lawyers for the arts, or critics, or other artists. Every single word was important, and my thinking expanded. And maybe I didn't have immediately market results, but I do feel that it has contributed a lot to me. Probably for some other alumni, it has contributed in a more specific way, like selling more work or finding venues. For me, was especially the people and their and how they've made part of my artwork as well.
Well, it's also a philosophy, a way of approaching it, isn't it? Like kind of like the Whitney Independent Study Program that artists in the marketplace, and you know, I haven't been in it or not an alumni of it, but it seems that there's a very special kind of nurturing towards you know, a particular type of contemporary art, which is you know, more open-ended in terms of what the definition of art even means. And so I don't know what you were reading there or exactly what you were discussing, but it sounds like it was also intellectually a very rich environment, is what I'm saying.
Very, very. One of the moments I remember, even though it was, as I was saying, many years ago, was we were to invent our own curated show with whoever artist we wanted, from the past, from the future, from, well, not from the future, from the present, famous, not famous, any kind of artist. So for me to write this proposal, to look at all the art, to think about connections and communication, what I'm communicating, what are they communicating, was incredibly valuable.
Right, because then you're looking at things for the first time from outside the artist's perspective at other artists, which is almost like looking at yourself in a way, which is hard to do.
Yes, and it also gave me an opening into something which I hadn't thought about, which is like I always thought, oh, this is not possible, this is not possible. And when I did something which seemed so impossible or unlikely, and if you say, what if I can do this and this and this, then suddenly it becomes in part reality. So every time now I think of something to curate or to do or to make, I ask myself the same question, what if I could? So this makes it already like halfway through, I can.
Right. I like that. Let me ask you this, and before we go, what is it that, what kind of books are you reading now? I always ask people what books they're reading. It could be fiction or nonfiction, but what are you reading at the moment?
So I'm reading these days, as usual, couple of things together. One of them is a book of a person I met recently called Shelley Marlowe. She's an artist and a writer, and her book is called 2 Augusts in a row, and it's just amazing. It's about New York during a couple of decades. And it has humor, it has strength, I'm loving it. And then I'm rereading Margaret Atwood's The Year of the Flood. I don't know if you've heard of this one. It's part of a trilogy called the Mad Adam trilogy. I'm very interested in dystopias and how they're... Now, instead of one dystopia or two dystopias, we have all the dystopias converging. Even Orwell and Huxley, who were always arguing about, well, no, mine is the dystopia which will happen. No, mine it will be. But now they're all happening. So there is no more contradictions in their dystopias, but they're converging. So Margaret Atwood is one of the creators of dystopias, which I think are happening very rapidly.
Eva, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure getting to know your work.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.